1 Corinthians 3:10 through 3:15, Rewards Revisited, the 27th talk in a series titled The Bible's Greatest Hits, was presented by Ron Julian on May 12, 1998, at an evening class of McKinsey Study Center, an institute of Gutenberg College. The copyright for this recording is held by Gutenberg College, Inc., 2012. Gutenberg College is a nonprofit organization, and contributions may be made at www.gutenberg.edu. This material may be copied and distributed in whole for non-commercial and educational purposes, subject to the inclusion of this introduction. All other rights reserved. A brief break occurs in the middle of the following recording. It is the result of the original audio tape switching to the second side.
We're going to be looking at some material in 1 Corinthians chapter 3 tonight. I just need to tell you right up front the sort of thing that we're going to be doing tonight. We're going to be talking exegesis. We're going to be taking on this passage and trying to figure out what it is that Paul is saying here. This is a passage that, in order to go at it at all, we're going to have to wander far and wide. We're going to have to look at background from other books. We're going to have to wander around several other chapters besides the one that we're looking at. In fact, that's one of the main reasons that we picked this passage to talk about as one of the key passages to understand. It is not that the theological issue that you confront in this passage is the most important or central to the gospel, although I think it is an important one. I hope we'll see a little bit why that is. But it's not that we think that this passage describes a fundamental truth about Christianity that must be understood. I mean, some of the things we've looked at in Romans and James, we're talking about faith and works and how those things fit together. Those are really key core issues that define how we think about what it means to be a Christian. What does the Bible say about the child of God, what the child of God looks like, what is the choice that we face, what is the picture that the Bible is painting? That's not the reason that we picked this passage tonight. The main reason we picked this passage is because it's a very, very clear example of the importance of interpreting in context. This is a passage that we've used for years and years. I mean, I can remember hearing Jack use this passage in interpretation class probably 25 years ago. We're getting close to that. I'm not promising anything for you tonight, but I have had the experience with students in the past and talking to people in the past where it's this passage that first sort of turns the light on for them in recognizing that it makes a difference whether you just pull a passage out of context and try to interpret it on its own, or whether you actually go in and look at the book and the argument that's happening there and try to see what is it that the author is talking about. Because in this case, what I want to argue is there's a very common interpretation of the passage that we're going to look at that is just dead wrong. It's just wrong. And it's not that hard to see that it's wrong if you stop and you back up and you look and follow the argument through the book. The reason that it's a popular way of interpreting this passage is that oftentimes people don't stop and put the whole argument together, but they just sort of pull it out and go for it. So the main lesson tonight is I want to exhort us to read the Bible as if it was written by people who were trying to communicate something. If you were writing a letter to someone and somewhere in the middle of that letter you made a reference to a friend of yours, and that friend came along and pulled out one sentence and said, "Well, what'd you mean by that?" You would naturally say, "Well, you know, I think you'd have a lot better shot at understanding what I meant by that if you started at the beginning of the letter and read the whole thing. So then you'd know what I was talking about and you'd know why I said what I said." Well, that's what we need to do with the Bible, and this is a great example of that, I think. So let me read you the passage that we're talking about. We're in 1 Corinthians chapter 3, and pretty well-known passage, I think. Let's start with verse 10 of chapter 3. According to the grace of God, which was given to me, as a wise master builder, I laid a foundation, and another is building upon it. But let each man be careful how he builds upon it. For no man can lay a foundation other than the one which is laid, which is Jesus Christ. Now if any man builds upon the foundation with gold, silver, precious stones, wood, hay, straw, each man's work will become evident, for the day will show it, because it is to be revealed with fire, and the fire itself will test the quality of each man's work. If any man's work which he has built upon it remains, he shall receive a reward. If any man's work is burned up, he shall suffer loss, but he himself shall be saved, yet so as through fire. And maybe you're familiar, maybe not, with what is a common way of using this passage, is to say this is a passage that one of the main passages that teaches us about the doctrine of rewards, that there is a reward for me to be found when Jesus returns and his kingdom is established that depends on how well I have lived my life. The picture here is the foundation is laid of my faith. I'm a believer and I'm going to be saved. But the question is, how do I build on that foundation? If I build with precious materials, and then we could argue what that might be, I do good works or works of faith or something like that, then I will receive a reward. If I build with poor materials, I will be saved because I'm a believer, but I will receive no reward and everything that I did will be burned up. So this passage is often used to exhort us to do good works in this life because we're determining the level of reward that we are going to get in the next life by how well we do now. And that's what I'm saying is just not what this passage is teaching. This is not what it is talking about. Now, I can't prove conclusively just from this passage that the entire doctrine of rewards is wrong, but what I can argue here is that it is not taught in this passage. And that's what I want to talk about tonight. In order to do that, as I said, you're just going to have to hang on. We're going to wander hither and yon, talking about various things. And I hope in this process to sort of model for you what I think we really need to do when we come to a passage like this. First of all, we need to understand that this letter is a letter written by Paul to a particular group of people talking about a particular situation. There is something going on that he's writing to them about. And so it would be helpful if we knew something about the situation. What is it that he's talking about? To whom is he talking? And what's going on? So let me just take you to a couple of passages to get a little background. We can start in the 18th chapter of Acts. And I leave it up to you whether you want to wander around with me as we go to these various passages. We see Paul on his second missionary journey. In the beginning of chapter 18, after these things, he left Athens and went to Corinth. This is Paul's introduction to the community that the letter 1 Corinthians is written to. So here's where Paul meets the Corinthians, and we see how he comes in. He meets Aquila and Priscilla. He stays in Corinth for a year and a half, preaching the gospel, working as a tent maker or a leather worker or whatever it is we should understand he's doing there. He's there in the town for a year and a half. He establishes the church in Corinth. There were not Christians in Corinth before he arrived. A number of things happen that we read about. And finally, we read about how in 18, Paul, having remained many days longer, took leave of the brethren and put out to sea for Syria, and with him were Priscilla and Aquila. No, wait a minute. Okay, did I miss the Ephesus part? Let me see. Right, no, I think we're okay. And so we see Paul taking off, going over to Ephesus, and then leaving and going back to Antioch where he came from. In verse 24, we read about a certain Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the Scriptures. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he was speaking and teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus. Priscilla and Aquila take him aside, explain the gospel to him more adequately. In verse 27 we read, "And when he wanted to go across to Achaia, the brethren encouraged him and wrote to the disciples to welcome him. And when he had arrived, he helped greatly those who had believed through grace. For he powerfully refuted the Jews in public, demonstrating by the Scriptures that Jesus was the Christ." So you have to picture, we've got Greece over on this side and Ephesus over on this side and a body of water between them. Corinth is over here. Paul stays for a year and a half in Corinth, comes over to Ephesus and leaves. Apollos comes along to Ephesus, where now Priscilla and Aquila are. He meets them. He has things explained to him more adequately. He only had a very rudimentary understanding of what was going on, but he was a very eloquent man, a powerful debater, and they send him over to Achaia, they say, that is, over to Greece, to Corinth. So Paul has left, and now Apollos, this new convert, powerful, eloquent speaker, has come over to Corinth. Paul is out, Apollos is in. Okay? That's the first part of the picture that we need to get. Now, another important part of this picture is this description of Apollos as an eloquent speaker, a powerful debater. Let me contrast what we read about Apollos and the power of his rhetoric with something that Paul says in the letter to the second letter to the Corinthians. We're in chapter 10 of 2 Corinthians. This letter is written not long after 1 Corinthians, and we still see in it the evidence of the same sort of problem that Paul was having with the Corinthians that we see in 1 Corinthians. So this is all kind of part of the same package. In chapter 10 of 2 Corinthians, verse 10, Paul says, "For they say, his letters are weighty and strong, but his personal presence is unimpressive, and his speech contemptible. Let such a person consider this, that what we are in word by letters when absent, such persons we are also in deed when present." So Paul is saying that many people are complaining that he, far from being an eloquent speaker, is his speech is contemptible. His personal presence is unimpressive. The Corinthians, who knew Paul for a year and a half, he had lived with them for a year and a half, some of them are saying this is a poor excuse for an apostle. And we can see further evidence of that in chapter 11 of 2 Corinthians, verse 5, where he says, "For I consider myself not in the least inferior to the most eminent apostles. But even if I am unskilled in speech, yet I am not so in knowledge. In fact, in every way we have made this evident to you in all things." So you see what he's saying. You guys are accusing me of being less than the other apostles, of being contemptible in my speech, of being unskilled as a speaker. And so he says, I don't think that I am inferior to them in anything. But even if I grant you that I'm not a very skillful speaker, I will not grant you that I am lacking in knowledge in any way. In other words, he's saying, it doesn't matter whether I'm skilled at speaking or not. What I am saying is true. I understand the things that I'm talking about. So you had better listen up. You had better pay attention. So I would argue that this information is very relevant to us as we come into the letter, the first letter to the Corinthians. That what we know is Paul left, having founded the church there, and Apollos came in, an eloquent man who was powerful, especially at debate. Paul, the Corinthians think, is unimpressive in his speech, and they don't even, some of them don't even want to consider him as being an apostle at all. And so you have this situation where the new guy comes in who's very eloquent, and the old guy has gone out, who many of them think is unimpressive in his speech. That creates the situation that we find in Corinth when we come into the first letter that Paul talks about. Because let me point you to a couple of verses in the first four chapters, really, this whole theme is playing itself out. What we see is a situation has arisen in Corinth where people are choosing up sides. And although he mentions several parties, it's clear that the biggest problem is that there are a group of people who are saying, we like Apollos better than we like Paul. In chapter 1, verse 10, he says, "Now I exhort you, brethren, by the name of our Lord Jesus Christ, that you all agree, and there be no divisions among you, but you be made complete in the same mind and in the same judgment. For I have been informed concerning you, my brethren, by Chloe's people, that there are quarrels among you. Now I mean this, that each one of you is saying, I am of Paul, and I of Apollos, and I of Cephas, and I of Christ." Here's the theme that he's introducing. There's this party spirit that is developed, where people are identifying themselves as, not as Christians, disciples of Jesus, but I am a disciple of Paul. No, I don't like Paul, but I really like Apollos. I'm a disciple of Apollos. That's the situation that has developed. We might think, and I think sometimes people get the impression, that Paul's main concern in this letter is it's not nice, it's not loving to be having these divisions, that you need to be getting along with each other is his main concern. But I would argue as we go through and look at this that that's only a secondary concern. He does want them to get along. But even more on his mind is the problem of why have these splits developed in the first place? If you think about it, Paul is presenting himself as an apostle of Jesus Christ, one taught by Jesus, one who has an accurate understanding of the message that Jesus proclaimed. So the problem, as he sees it, is that a group of people have looked at him and his message and said, we really don't want to have anything to do with that because Paul is such an unimpressive speaker. There's a problem there. There is a problem of priorities. There's a problem of values. What is it that you think is valuable if you could look at the gospel I'm proclaiming and say it's not impressive enough? That's the question that he's exploring in the book. We can see other evidence of this split that is developing between those who are following Apollos and those who are following Paul. Notice in chapter 3, we're going to come back to this in a minute, in chapter 3, 4, when one says, I am of Paul, and another, I am of Apollos, are you not mere men? What then is Apollos, and what is Paul? See, again, he's emphasizing especially the problem between those who are on Apollos' team somehow and those who would identify themselves with Paul. In chapter 4, verse 6, he says, "Now these things, brethren, I have figuratively applied to myself and Apollos for your sakes, that in us you might learn not to exceed what is written, in order that no one of you may become arrogant in behalf of one against the other." So Paul is concerned that these parties have developed around Apollos and himself. But as I said, more than that, he is also very concerned to defend himself as an apostle. That is, they have used a certain criterion to judge whether he was adequate or not and rejected him. And what he's arguing is that they have chosen a poor criterion. They're not thinking about this right. He is in the process in this letter of defending himself and the way he speaks, the way he teaches. And so that's partly how we can see that the issue here between Apollos and himself is some of them think that Apollos is eloquent and they think that Paul is not. Because in this section, he's continually coming back to and defending the way he talked when he was with them. you see in chapter 1, verse 17. For Christ did not send me to baptize, but to preach the gospel, not in cleverness of speech, that the cross of Christ should not be made void. Why is he defending himself in this way? Why is he saying that God didn't send him to speak in a certain cleverness of speech? Well, it's because the Corinthians are complaining. Paul isn't very clever, is he? In this, he's so boring. He's so pedantic. He's so mundane. Now, Apollos, boy, he really gets the place jumping. But Paul, man, I have such a hard time staying awake when he's talking. In chapter 2, he says, "When I came to you, brethren, I did not come with superiority of speech or of wisdom, proclaiming to you the testimony of God. For I determined to know nothing among you except Jesus Christ and him crucified. And I was with you in weakness and fear and much trembling. And my message and my preaching were not in persuasive words of wisdom, but in demonstration of the Spirit and of power." And so on. Again, he's defending the way he spoke when he was there, because he's under attack by those who say that he doesn't speak very well. And in the beginning of chapter 3, again, "I, brethren, could not speak to you as to spiritual men, but as to men of flesh, as to babes in Christ." He's defending again the way he chose to speak to them when he was there. And then finally, I just might point out that at the beginning of chapter 4, he says, "Let a man regard us in this manner." And by us, he really means himself and perhaps the people who are with him. But mostly he's talking about himself. "Let a man regard us in this manner as servants of Christ and stewards of the mysteries of God. In this case, moreover, it is required of stewards that one be found trustworthy. But to me, it is a very small thing that I should be examined by you or by any human court." You see what he's saying? He sees himself as being examined by the Corinthians. They have, it's like that he's on trial. They're putting up there and saying, "What do you think? Is he worth listening to or not?" That's his concern throughout this, that this split, those who have aligned themselves with Apollos, have done so not just because they like Apollos, but because they don't like Paul. And from his perspective, that's a problem. Okay. All of this is very, very important for us as we come to look at the passage that you'll notice we haven't even looked at the passage that we're here to talk about tonight. And we're still not going to because we have a few other things to talk about. But all of this background is very important because this is what Paul is talking about as he's coming along through here. As we come into chapter 3, what's on his mind is this split between those who are on Apollos' side and those who are on his side, the way they are evaluating Paul or Apollos and putting one down and putting one above the other, the values that they are bringing to bear on that decision, all of that is what Paul has in mind. So, as we come into chapter 3 then, which is the chapter where our passage is to be found, we find Paul talking about it. We can look in verse 4. When one says, "I am of Paul," and another, "I am of Apollos, are you not mere men? What then is Apollos, and what is Paul? Servants through whom you believed, even as the Lord gave opportunity to each one." So Paul's first point here is, look, you guys are evaluating, playing Apollos off against me, saying, you know, Apollos is better than Paul, or maybe some would go the other direction, saying, how should you be thinking about us? You should be thinking about us as servants of God. God gave each of us a task to do. I am an apostle, Apollos is a teacher, and each of us has been given a role to play by God. And what you should think about us is each of you has this role to play that God has given you. You are a servant of God. Paul is a servant of God. Apollos is a servant of God. He's saying that's how you ought to be thinking about us. I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth. Okay, now here's where I'd really like you to sort of try to hang with me and pay attention, because now we're coming in for a landing. We're heading for the passage that we actually want to talk about, but this part is very crucial if we're going to understand what he's talking about here. What does he do? He creates a metaphor. He wants to describe the situation in terms of some other. So he says, I planted, Apollos watered, but God was causing the growth. Why does he... So here the picture is of a field, which is the Corinthian church, where Paul comes and he plants. Why does he use the imagery of him planting? It's because Paul was the first one there. Paul is the guy that started the church in Corinth. So he's the one who sowed the seed. He left, and Apollos comes along, and he pictures Apollos as watering what Paul had planted. And then for his purposes here, he's using this agricultural analogy because we're aware of thinking about how when you go out and plant seeds and water them, they grow up apart from your intervention. It's the seed isn't growing because I know how seeds grow or I know how to pull the plant out. I put them in the ground and I water them and they come up on their own. And so what he's saying is that's the situation here. I planted by proclaiming the gospel and Apollos watered by coming along and further teaching the gospel and arguing that Jesus is the Christ and confounding the Jews and all of that kind of stuff that's described. But the spiritual growth that resulted from this was not due to me, and it wasn't due to Apollos, it was due to God. God is the one who took that and brought something out of it. So how should you think about Paul and Apollos then? You should think about them, how impressed should you be with either one of them? You should be impressed with them the way you're impressed with the guy that puts seed in the ground, and then it grows up. You don't go, wow, what skill you had in putting that seed in the ground. The growth came from the seed itself, from this process that the Creator has put together, not from anything that the guy who planted did. That's the picture that Paul's trying to paint. He wants them to stop putting either one of them on a pedestal and think of them realistically. I'm a servant. I planted. Apollos is a servant. He watered. So then, neither the one who plants nor the one who waters is anything but God who causes the growth. Just further exploring that theme then. Now, he who plants and he who waters are one, but each will receive his own reward according to his own labor. So what he's saying here now is, okay, he who plants and he who waters are one, in the sense that, as he's already said, they are both just servants. Neither one of them is profoundly different than the other, in the sense that, in comparison to God, both of them are just servants doing their job. But, he says, each will receive his own reward according to his own labor. The word reward here, I think we would understand a little better what's happening if we translated it wage, because that's really what the word means in this kind of context. Paul is a laborer in the field, and Apollos is a laborer in the field. And at the end of the day, each of them's going to get his pay for what he did. What he's trying to say here now, and this is a little turn in his argument. Up to now, he's been talking about how should you think about us? You should just think about us as servants. But there is a judgment to be made. There is a question that could be asked, and that is, how faithfully has Apollos fulfilled this task? As a servant, if I plant the wrong seed, when the end of the day comes, the master is going to look at me and say, that's not what I told you to do, and I may not get my pay. I'm not going to like the result at the end if I don't fulfill the task that I have been given. So he brings up this little theme that is going to emerge more strongly here now, this idea that your judgment, you're putting one of us above the other and so on, that's really an inappropriate way to think about it. But there is an appropriate judgment that ultimately God himself will make, and that is the question of how faithfully has each of these servants fulfilled their task. Okay, so the issue being then, Paul, how well did he do Was he faithful in proclaiming the gospel to them? Apollos, how well has he done? Has he been wise and faithful in teaching the Corinthians after Paul left? Now, the key verse in understanding the whole argument in this passage, I would argue, is the next one, verse 9. For we are God's fellow workers, you are God's field, God's building. Now, we just had a metaphor where we're seeing Paul planted, Apollos watered, God was causing the growth, the Corinthians are the field. He's talking about the Paul evangelizing the Corinthians originally, and then Apollos coming along and adding to what Paul did by watering what he planted, right? Now, Paul is switching. He says, you are God's field, you Corinthians. You're the field where I planted the seed. You're the field where Apollos did the watering. Now I want to switch. I don't want to talk about you as a field. I want to talk about you as a building. You see what I'm saying? Well, no, he has successfully avoided that because he has jumped out of the one before he goes to the other one. But he has created two metaphors. I think he's managed to avoid getting them tangled up, but he has created two. Now, I made a little chart here to show you where I think we need to go as we start to think about these things. The reality that Paul is talking about is that God is at work in the Corinthian church. In his first metaphor, he says that the Corinthians church is God's field. In the second metaphor, he says that the Corinthian church is God's building. But both of these are pointing to the same reality, that this is a work that God is doing in the Corinthian church. Okay? What does he go on to say then? The reality that he points to is that Paul and Apollos are merely servants of God to the Corinthians. In his first metaphor, he says Paul and Apollos are field workers in God's field. In the next metaphor, what he goes on to say is that Paul and Apollos are builders of God's building. Just like they're the ones that planted and watered the field, which is the Corinthians, now Paul and Apollos are the ones who built the building that is the Corinthian church. Notice what Paul says. According to the grace of God, which was given to me as a wise master builder, I laid a foundation, and another is building upon it. Well, what did we have before? Paul planted and Apollos watered. Now we have the reality that Paul laid the foundation as a wise master builder and another is building upon it. You see what I'm saying? The reality is that Paul was the one who preached to the Corinthians first. He founded the church by preaching the gospel there. And he describes that with two metaphors. I planted and I laid the foundation. Then Apollos came along afterwards and continued on. He taught the Corinthians after Paul left. And he describes that in two ways. Apollos watered, he says explicitly here. And then he says, another is building upon it. But it's not hard to see if we just follow the thinking through who is the another that he's talking about here. It's Apollos. Apollos is coming along and continuing the work that Paul did. Okay? And so, what was the point that he made in the first metaphor? He's basically arguing that Paul and Apollos are each responsible before God for what they teach the Corinthians. Each of them is going to be held accountable for whether they taught truth or error to the Corinthians. Here he says, in the agricultural metaphor, he says, he who plants and he who waters are one, but each will receive his own wage or reward according to his own labor. What does he say here? Let each man be careful how he builds upon it, if any man builds with gold, etc. And he goes on to talk about the wage or reward that someone will get based on how they build on the foundation that was laid. So, my essential argument then is how we need to understand this passage is this is not Paul teaching each individual believer in his life needs to go on to build on his faith by doing good works. This is Paul saying that anybody who comes along and teaches the Corinthians after I do had better do it right. They had better build with good materials because they're going to reap the results of what they do just as I will reap the results for whether I laid the foundation right, whether I planted the seeds right. So I have another, you have to have charts to do this sort of thing. I apologize for them not being in color. Color charts are even better, but we have budgetary considerations around here. So what I'm saying is the metaphor of a builder does not refer to each individual believer building in his own life, but it does mean Apollos and anyone else who would come along and build on the work that Paul did. The building that we're talking about is not the life of each individual believer, but it is the Corinthian church. The foundation, building on the foundation, is not each individual believer adding to his own faith by doing good works. It is Apollos and anyone else coming along and adding to Paul's teaching after he left. And then the precious stones and the worthless stuff is not good works or bad works in the individual life of the believer, but the question is whether you're building wisely with the truth of the gospel, promoting what is godly and right, or whether you're teaching foolishly and leading the church astray. That's the issue in this passage. That's what Paul's talking about. He's essentially warning Apollos and anyone else involved in this stuff that it's a very serious thing that they have taken on to come along and teach the Corinthians after Paul has preached the gospel there. And if after laying a good foundation, someone else comes along and builds the building with rotten materials, then he says that's a very serious thing that's happening there. And the person who does that is going to reap the consequences. That's what Paul's saying, I would say. Now, we have to ask the question then, what are those consequences? He uses the word wage or reward, but I would argue that word comes from his analogy. I mean, what he's saying is, I'm a builder who's going to get my pay at the end of the day. I'm a planter who's going to get my pay at the end of the day. What does he mean by my pay? What is it? What are the consequences that he's talking about? Well, it seems to me that there are several possibilities. We could see this as evidence for some sort of a position that there are, there are great, you stars in your crown or, something like that you get at the end of the day. But I think we need to be careful about that and at least consider some other options when we come to a passage like this. Because what is it that Paul's describing? What is it that's happening here? If I'm right in what I'm picturing, someone comes along and spends his time teaching the Corinthians after Paul has done so, and at the end, somehow there is a reckoning where you look at the building and you say, this building's rotten. This isn't worth anything. This didn't work. And so this work of my life and pouring myself out into trying to help and teach other people ends up coming to nothing. It ends up being judged by reality and saying, this was rotten. This didn't go anywhere. So it seems to me that there is another possibility for understanding what the wage is at the end of the day. That there are many times when Paul talks about how when Jesus returns, he talks to the people that he has taught and written to, and he says, you are my joy and my crown. I mean, there's this idea that when Jesus returns, you'll be standing there with me and to be able to testify that my impact on your life was good. What I did helped you. I taught you the gospel and you're glad that I did it. So this passage, it seems to me, doesn't tell us explicitly that there's anything like, you know, you're going to have charge over so many planets or anything like that. It's just the idea is at the end of the day, reality is either going to show this building, the Corinthian church, in other words, the influence that I had on it as it's standing solid and strong because I built with good materials. And so my reward will be, well done, good and faithful servant. I mean, what you invested your life in was worth investing your life in, and the work you did was solid and good. Or else, in the end, the whole thing burns, reality comes along, fire sweeps through the place, and you find that all the materials were rotten, and nothing is left standing except the foundation, which was built well. That's the foundation that Paul laid. And so I'm left with everything that I invested myself in turned to ashes and gone. It seems to me that that picture in and of itself shows you at least a very significant picture of what kind of a wage I might be looking for in the sort of work that he's talking about. The issue is, when you presume to teach other people, are you building up and promoting something that is good and solid? You're teaching the truth, you're encouraging other people to follow the truth, and the structure in the end is something good and worthwhile, or in the end does it fall apart? I would argue then that at a minimum, this passage, we can say two things when it comes to the doctrine of rewards. First of all, this says nothing about the average Christian earning rewards for doing good works or anything like this. Paul is specifically concerned with what Apollos and others are doing when they come and they teach the Corinthian church. That's what he's talking about. And we can also say then, I think, that this passage doesn't explicitly tell us anything about a doctrine of every believer getting rewards. It doesn't contradict it, but it doesn't really explicitly tell us anything about that. So as we go to try to put together our doctrine of rewards, is there such a thing as rewards for believers in the age to come, we need to be careful that we're using this passage to say what it is really saying and not take it in another direction. Now, let me just get on my soapbox here for a minute, not that I haven't been on it already, but about the process of interpretation for a minute. I can remember at churches I've been involved with hearing this passage used to teach the, you know, how important it is that I do good works in my life because my rewards are dependent on it. And I can remember people saying to me that their entire motivation in living the Christian life was, I want to get my rewards when I enter into the next life and the next age. What I want to say is, I think it's very important for us to let the Bible say to us what it is really trying to say. That if I'm going to use something as a source of exhortation and encouragement, that I ought to be exhorted and encouraged by the things that the Bible is really and actually saying, and not by ideas that I have constructed in my head because I have not paid very much attention to what the passage is teaching. Why is it that a lot of people take this passage and use it to teach that each individual will be judged by how many good works they do? How does that happen? I would argue that it happens because we are impatient when we come to the Bible. And I'm not exempting myself from that. I am trying to learn not to be impatient when I come to the Bible. But I think all of us feel that sense of urgency. I can remember being in Bible studies where if you were to stop and ask a question like this about this passage, you would be accused of being too intellectual and trying to, you're trying to avoid what the passage is saying to you. What you need to do is, you know, listen to it with embrace it and do what it tells you. But you see what I guess I'm trying to get across here is that I can't go and do what the Bible tells me until I know what it is that the Bible has said. And one of the things that's really important, if I want to know what the Bible has said, is that I understand it in context. Now, this is something that has been obvious to me for a long time. Why is it that we jump in and start reading at verse 10 of chapter 3? It's because that's where the good stuff is from our perspective. That's where it talks about rewards. Why don't we read the stuff that comes before it? Because that's the boring stuff that talks about Apollos and Paul and a bunch of people who have been dead for 2,000 years. What relevance is it to me? What do I care whether Apollos was getting along with the Corinthians or what Paul thought of them or what they thought of him? What does it matter to me? I mean, we're tempted to think. I can't do anything about it now. They're all long gone. But the question of whether I'm going to get rewards is very interesting to me, and so I go and I jump on that passage and I really run with it. What I want to exhort us to do is, ultimately, each of us has to embrace the ideas in the Bible, look at them, decide if they are true, and if we decide they are true, we ought to embrace them with passion and say, this is true, and it makes a difference, and I ought to live my life differently because this is true. So ultimately, there is a great passionate involvement in what the Bible says. But before I invest myself in that passionate involvement, I have to step back with the cool, dispassionate sort of attempt to figure out what is it that it's actually saying. I need to chill out on it a little bit and just step back and say, I know that I want it to answer this question, but I need to be open to the possibility that it doesn't answer that question, that it answers another question. And so I need to stop and ask myself those things about who was Apollos and why is he saying this stuff. Even though they're not people who are around anymore, these are the people and situations that Paul is writing about. Paul is writing to people who know Apollos, and they have been talking to Apollos, and this problem has developed. I mean, these are the topics that are on Paul's mind, and if we don't notice that these are the topics that are on Paul's mind, then we're going to miss it. We're going to end up reading our own situation into the text. And there's a lot of difference, I guess is what I'm trying to get across here, between applying the Bible to my life and reading my own situation into the text. There's a step that you have to take that's missing in there. I have to first figure out what the Bible is talking about in its own situation. What was on Paul's mind? What was the problem that these people were having? What was his exhortation to them in their situation? Then, after I'm sure that I know what he was saying to them, then I can ask the question, what does what he said to them have to do with me? And I need to ask that question. But I need to ask both those questions. If I just say, how is the Bible relevant to me, without asking what is it saying in its own context, then I'm going to be applying something that's not true. And if I just ask the question, what is the Bible saying, but I don't ever personally engage with it and apply it to my life, then it's just an intellectual game. But both of them are a danger. The person who is passionately saying, I'm reading the Bible and applying it to my life, had better not be pointing the finger at the person who's looking up the Greek words and trying to figure out what's happening in the text, because those two things are not in conflict. Both of those things need to be happening. I need to know what it says so that I can decide what I, in my own life, am going to do with what it says. The reason I tell the story a lot is because it's one of the formative experiences in my life. I mean, if you want to ask, how did this person here get to this spot? One of the things that got me to this spot is an experience I had at a Bible study one night, where the study was in 2 Corinthians. It's another passage where I think there's a misapplication that's being taken from this passage. But I was sitting there, fairly young Christian at this point, looking at the passage and listening to everybody sort of saying, you know, this is what the passage means to me, and isn't it wonderful, and there's all these great things in this passage. And it occurred to me, you know, I don't think that's what's happening in this passage. I don't think that it's saying what they're saying it's saying. And so I made the observation, you know, look at this here. Look at the way this argument is going. I think this is talking about something else. And one of the points I made in this passage was, I don't think that Paul is saying this statement that he makes here. I don't think he's saying it about all Christians. I think he's saying it about himself. This is a statement about Paul, not about a statement about what's true of every believer, but this is a statement about what's true as Paul the Apostle, I said. And the response I got from the group was not, I thought that this would start a very interesting conversation about what the passage is talking about, but it sort of brought a chill on the room, and one of the adult leaders in the group said to me, what relevance is it to me, this passage, if Paul is talking about himself? And what she said is, God, the Bible is God's love letter to me. And so, if that's talking about Paul, then it's not God's love letter to me anymore, and it's no good to me. And like I said, this was a very formative experience for me, because I sort of had to come face to face with that question. What do I do with that? Is the Bible God's love letter to me? And I decided, well, not exactly, because the Bible is made up of a bunch of books, and one of them is this letter to the Corinthians, which is not God's love letter to me, but it is Paul's chewing out letter to the Corinthians, is what it is. And I'm not going to be able to understand what's going on there until I understand what Paul was saying to them. So I guess what I like about teaching this passage here is I think it shows us the choice that we have to make. I'm arguing that you ought to land on the side of, I want to know what Paul meant when he was talking to the Corinthians. And if you land there, then you have to do something like what we're talking about here tonight. You have to go back and look at things like context and background and the language that he used. You know, what did this Greek word mean? And all those kinds of things. Those are not intellectual games that we use to avoid the text. They are tools that we use to discover what it is that Paul was really saying, so then that we don't avoid the text, but the text actually has a chance to really say to me what it has to say. So that's my soapbox, and you can take that for what it's worth. So we're going to have a question and answer time now, but as always, for those who need to leave, this is an opportunity for you to slip quietly away, and the rest of us will take any questions or comments or just about anything at all.
Well, you were bringing it up on Paul and Apollos.
Uh-huh.
And David, you know, telling me you shouldn't look at it. And
right.
Don't you think you can get hung up on the person? One or the other, one was more eloquent, and it reminds you of the Old Testament, you know, when Aaron was a much better speaker than
right.
Moses and all that stuff.
Right.
But Moses had the faith, and Aaron had the fault, you know,
right.
the eloquent of speech. You know.
Right.
Well, you can get hung up on both these guys. And you can forget what God was trying to get to you.
Right. Yes.
You miss the whole thing. Just
right. And that's what Paul is really concerned about, is that they're so concerned about which of them is more eloquent and so forth. And yet, here Paul, who to many of them seems like an uneloquent speaker, he's saying, as he describes in chapter 2, what I'm speaking is the wisdom of God. I mean, what does it matter whether I'm an eloquent orator or not? What I'm teaching you is the gospel that I have been taught by God himself. I mean, so you've missed the point. What you should have been looking for is, what am I saying? What is this about? Because that's where the material is. That's where the truth is. And he's saying to them that they are essentially worldly people. They're concerned about, in their culture, of one of the things I didn't talk about, but as you try to look at what was going on in Corinth, the Greeks really valued this eloquence and the ability to debate. They thought somebody was really, really slick if he could decimate all his opponents in debate. And that's what is described in Acts. That's exactly what Apollos was good at. That's why the Corinthians thought he was so great, because he was like a Jewish sophist. The sophists are these Greek debaters who, you know, were very impressive. And they are looking at Apollos and saying, boy, that's really great. But Paul's saying, what does it matter how eloquently a person speaks if what he is saying is the truth from God himself? So yeah, you're exactly right. And we can do that. We can end up doing that same thing today, is getting hung up on the personality of one person over another and something, and missing the more fundamental question of, is he speaking the truth or not? Is he teaching the truth of the gospel or not? And yeah, that absolutely, that's true.
Yeah. It seems like today it might not be so much the individual who debates so well. It might be the church that has such a wonderful sense of community, mm-hmm. or such a an exciting emotional worship service or something like that, that we could be so enamored with those things, which can be in and of themselves really good things, but become so enamored with them that we might go into a church where the truth is being proclaimed, but it's, you know, we for various reasons might sense or not feel like it's, you know,
kind of dull.
It's kind of dull, or you know, it's not a lot of warm fuzzy feelings. And we might walk out of there and go into another church that has a very strong sense of sort of family, community, or things that can be good, and end up sort of not caring that much about whether or not they're preaching the truth. In fact, they might even not be preaching the truth.
Right. And as you say, community or a certain feel, those are not necessarily bad things, just like eloquence is not a bad thing. I hope I'm not miscommunicating. Paul is not accusing Apollos of doing anything wrong in being eloquent. It's great that he's eloquent. What's wrong is that the Corinthians are looking at that and saying that's more important than what Paul has to say. That's the problem. So it's not that Paul's advice to us is that we should all be as boring as possible when we speak. But what he's saying is, you had better be paying attention to the substance of it rather than the, you know, the steak rather than the sizzle kind of thing, you know.
You didn't go all this way, it seems to me, but I'm assuming that it's also a useful metaphor for how we build on the foundation of what's been given to us in the faith as a believer.
Yes, I think so.
Okay.
We're not in the situation where we can... None of us can say that the foundation is so well laid in any particular church. I mean, Paul himself didn't come along and preach to this group. But we have the next best thing in the scriptures, where Paul's message and the other apostles' message is to be found. So yeah, any one of us is coming along, and I mean, I am, as a person who's standing up here and telling you, here's something that's going on in the Bible, I'm like Apollos in the sense I'm watering the seeds that Paul planted in having written this letter and that kind of thing. We're all in that same kind of situation. I think it's pretty analogous.
I mean, I'm speaking in terms of what we do in our own day-to-day, how we grow in our understanding, what responsibilities we take. It also comes to that, or do you not see it being relevant there?
Well, I'd have to think about that for a minute. His concern here is... Notice the very next thing he goes on to say, he talks about destroying the temple of God, which I think a lot of times that passage as well is pulled out of context, and it's very common to hear people say, okay, well, later on Paul talks about my body as a temple, and so here it says destroying the temple of God, so that means if I'm smoking or something, I'm destroying the temple of God, and so I'm going to be destroyed myself. But notice in the context, the you that he's talking about, you are a temple, this is the same, this is the field and the building that he's just been talking about. It is the Corinthians, the Corinthian church, which is the temple. He's warning that to build with poor materials here, to come along and to teach foolishness instead of wisdom, to promote foolishness after Paul has laid this good foundation, is going to have serious consequences. But now I think his final word is to those, we know that there are opponents in Corinth who actively oppose Paul and who want to teach something different than what Paul taught. And so if it's not just a matter of even, you know, building poorly, but actually seeking to undo what it is that Paul did, he's saying, you're destroying the temple of God. This is a holy place where God is at work in the lives of these people here, and to seek to destroy it, if you're a destroyer of the temple of God, God will destroy you, he says. So what I am saying is the focus of this is very much on the person who has taken it upon themselves to influence other people. That's his. There are two things on his mind. You Corinthians are looking at your teachers and evaluating them foolishly. And then we step over here. You teachers had better be paying attention to what you're doing. You had better be paying attention to how you're influencing them. Kind of, we know that Paul and Apollos are reconciled at this point. Apollos is with Paul at the time that the letter is being written. So Paul is not saying Apollos is a bad guy. But I think there is a kind of gentle note of warning that this young, eager, eloquent guy comes in, and we've got the situation where he's got a bunch of groupies now around him who are saying, well, Paul, we don't want to have anything to do with him. I think he's sort of urging Apollos to stop a minute and take some care, think about what are you trying to accomplish here? You know, what ultimately has been the result of what you're doing? You need to think about what you're shooting for here. So that's Apollos. But then there are these other folks who are just out-and-out opponents of Paul that he's saying, essentially, if you're seeking to undo what I have done, the consequences for you will be serious. I mean, you're making yourself an enemy of God. So, I don't know how to answer your question, because he obviously is very concerned with how the Corinthians are, like I said, he has these two concerns. And one of them is the Corinthians themselves, how they're conducting themselves, having heard the gospel and say they believe it, but now they're running after really foolish and worldly ideas. Yes, he's very concerned with how they are conducting themselves as believers. But the wood, hay, and stubble stuff, I would say his focus is on, when he talks about building with wood, hay, and stubble, he's talking about What sort of an influence are you having on these people? What are you doing to this church, I think. Does that answer your question? Are you inclined to see it differently? If so, why?
Well, no, I'm not inclined to see it differently at all. I'm confused at your hesitancy to say, yes, it also goes... because it immediately strikes me, looking at the verse, that, oh, and what an apt metaphor for how I build a life of faith for myself. So when your hesitancy to say yes, and it also is that, confuses me.
Well, but see, there's a difference between saying this would be an apt metaphor for that, and this is what Paul means by the metaphor that he uses. I mean, we could construct a number of situations where we might be able to say that this is an apt metaphor for that, where we would all easily agree that that's not what Paul meant. It'd be a great metaphor for it, but it wasn't his metaphor. It wasn't what he was trying to get across. My hesitancy is, I think that he's constructing this metaphor specifically because he has a two-step process. I started it, and Apollos came along and did something later. Planting, watering, foundation, building upon. That's why this metaphor exists for him. is to say, look, you know, each of us is going to be accountable for how we do this thing. So, of course, yes, it is an apt metaphor, and we could use it that way. All I'm saying is, I don't think that's what Paul was saying. Okay. Now, would he have a problem with using the metaphor that way? No. I mean, obviously, he does care about how we go on and build on our faith, but I'm just saying I don't think that's what he means. You said you had two questions.
Yeah, my other question was, what does it mean back in Acts that of Apollos, that he taught accurately on Jesus, but he only knew the baptism of John?
Yes. Well, that's a very good question.
The Messiah was coming, and then when they took him under their wing and told him that he came, you missed it, but here's the story. Is that what happened?
Well, let's go back and look. We're in Acts 18 or 19 there. Let's start with verse 24 of 18 so we can follow this through. Now, a certain Jew named Apollos, an Alexandrian by birth, an eloquent man, came to Ephesus, and he was mighty in the scriptures. Okay, so we know some things about Apollos. He's Jewish. He's from Alexandria in Egypt. And you're probably familiar with the fact that the Jews were spread all over the Mediterranean because of the conquests in the past and so on. So there was a very big community of Jews in Alexandria, and Apollos is from there. Okay. He was mighty in the scriptures. This man had been instructed in the way of the Lord, and being fervent in spirit, he was speaking and teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus, being acquainted only with the baptism of John. And he began to speak out boldly in the synagogue. I think it's hard to be too... We don't know a lot about what the situation is. It says that he was teaching accurately concerning the things of Jesus, and he knew the baptism of John, so I assume that he would have known that John the Baptist was proclaiming that this was the time, that he was the forerunner, that the Messiah was here. And he probably knew, it would be hard to imagine at this point that he hadn't heard something of the fact that John had said, that's the guy, Jesus is the guy. Because it says that he's teaching accurately the things concerning Jesus. So, maybe we could get around that, but it sounds as if that he knows the name of Jesus and would identify Jesus as the one that John the Baptist proclaimed. At this point, that makes the most sense to me, that he actually would have been able to take it that far. But when Priscilla and Aquila heard him, they took him aside and explained to him the way of God more accurately. I'm assuming that we're moving on now from... His focus would have been that the time is here, the Messiah is here, John the Baptist proclaimed him, let me show you in the Old Testament what it says about the Messiah, and so on. But he doesn't know much about actually the ministry of Jesus, what Jesus taught, what the apostles have gone on to say about the significance of his death and resurrection. And I mean, there's a lot in his teaching, a lot about the nature of the kingdom of God and all of that kind of stuff that perhaps Apollos was not familiar with. So he may have had, I mean, who knows? He may have had some strange ideas about when the kingdom of God was going to be established or how it was going to work itself out or something. He knew, he believed John's message, and he could demonstrate from the Old Testament the kind of thing that John would have been able to demonstrate, but he hasn't really yet understood, you know, Jesus had a lot of stuff to say that was relatively new, at least putting things together in a way that even the people that followed him were not really prepared for. They really had to kind of take it in. So I'm assuming that Apollos is in the position that, you know, that Peter would have been in when he's saying, you're the Christ, but it's clear that he really doesn't understand a lot of what it is that Jesus is saying yet and what that's all about. I'm assuming it's something like that, that he needs to be brought up to speed about, you know, there's a lot that we understand about this, Apollos, that you haven't heard yet. Something like that, I'm assuming. Now, if you want to argue that he's teaching the things accurately concerning Jesus, But he doesn't know that it's Jesus that he's talking about. I'd be willing to consider that as an alternative, but it seems to be suggesting that he knew that Jesus was the guy. But I think we could see how that could happen if we realize the radical nature of what it is that Jesus had to say. If you just take his message and ministry and then what the apostles go on to do with that, he's correcting an awful lot in the understanding of the apostles and the people around him when he's teaching. Just about all of Jesus' teaching, in a sense, is coming along and correcting the model that the people had. He's not talking to unreligious people when Jesus comes and preaches. He's talking to Jews who knew the teachings of the Pharisees and went to the synagogue, and they knew the Old Testament in general terms, at least. So he's not coming along and saying, I don't know if you've heard about this, but God exists. That's not his message. He's coming to people who already assume all of that and saying, your understanding of what this is all about is wrong. It's like this instead. So I think Apollos is in that spot where he's sort of gotten halfway there. He's figured out who Jesus is, but he hasn't really yet understood how things that he has picked up from his Judaism needed to be corrected and put together in a different way. Something like that, I think. Nate?
Do you think people are assuming the rewards of heaven are? I don't understand exactly what that could be.
What they would be?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, well, people look at them in different ways. I imagine most of the time, the thing that I'm most familiar with is using the language from some of Jesus' parables. There are a couple of parables that Jesus tells where a master leaves servants in charge. There's the parable of the talents. I don't know if you've heard that one before. The master gives some money to each of the servants, and he comes back and he says, well done, good and faithful servant. I'm going to put you in charge of 5 cities. You know, and so I think people will often extrapolate from that and say, well, there must be some corollary kind of thing. Your reward is you get a more important job or more responsibility or something like
that. On your side of the
street. Well, people use that kind of language too. I mean, people talk about stars in your crown and that kind of thing. I just think we need to be careful. I think it is clear that there is this concept that a general judgment on my life is going to be passed either well done, good and faithful servant, or not. And I think that's clearly a biblical idea. But the idea that I am working to earn certain privileges in the kingdom of heaven and that ought to be my priority in my thinking, that's the thing that most bothers me about some of the things about rewards that I've been exposed to, is when I read the Bible over and over and over and over and over again, what I find is my great hope and expectation is I will find my place in the kingdom of God. And it will be everything that life ought to be. I will be redeemed. I will be forgiven. I will be freed from sin and death. And life will be good and satisfying. I will be with God. I will know God the way I would like to know him. I will know you the way I would like to know you. I mean, this is the culmination of my existence, finally arriving at what life is supposed to be. And I think the appropriate attitude to have towards that is, I would rather be the janitor in the kingdom of heaven than the king of any place else. I mean, that the kingdom of heaven is my reward. The kingdom of God is my wage. It is what I am looking for. And if in God's good pleasure he decides that some people will have more important jobs than other people, great. I mean, that's fine, and it may very well be that that's how it works itself out. But the Bible's message to me isn't, okay, that salvation stuff, that's all taken care of. You went forward and believed in Jesus. Now let's get you some rewards. The Bible's message to me over and over again is, Ron, every day of your life, you're facing the question, do you want the kingdom of God? Do you believe the gospel? Is that what your life is about or not? And so the Bible isn't urging me so much to get myself a good position in heaven. It's urging me to get there. It is urging me to embrace it and to long for it and to seek after it. So if there are rewards as a part of that package, that's fine. But when somebody says to me, the driving goal of my life is rewards in heaven, I think that's a misunderstanding of the Bible's exhortation. The Bible's exhortation to me is, look at this world, look at the promises of God, and decide, this is better. This world is passing away. The promise of God stands forever. So that's what I want. And if I do that, which I must do as a believer, that's what I am called to do. If I do that, then I am a blessed person. And
you're not more blessed or less blessed?
Right. I think the biblical teaching would be that every single person who ends up in the kingdom of God is absolutely, incredibly, and totally well off. That's it. That's where you want to be. And so the goal of my life is to be there. If I'm pursuing faithfulness in my life now, it's not so I can get a better position there so much as it is I want to pursue the things of the faith today because I don't want to turn away from God. I want to turn toward Him. I think that's the biblical message, as I would understand it. So my only real quarrel with rewards is, if you put it together right, it sort of becomes a competitor almost with the gospel. I have heard people say things that almost come down to essentially, oh yeah, you know, sure, well, you know, you will be saved and go to heaven and everything, but boy, won't it be terrible if you get there and you find out that, you know, you don't get any rewards. No rewards? Death is gone. Sin is gone. I'm with God forever. Life is everything that it was always supposed to be. What a terrible thing. I didn't get any rewards. I mean, that kind of thinking, I think, is just has not understood yet how great the gospel is. The gospel is great. And if there are any rewards involved, they're just this little veneer that's painted on the top. But the promise of the gospel itself is the reward that we're seeking after.
Go ahead. Yes. Why do you have rewards? Is you work because you've been saved, not to be saved. That's when it's a normal thing for you then to work, because you are grateful for what the Lord did for you.
And sure.
Yeah.
That's the only reason why you really. I mean, you want to do it because of what He did for you. To promote yourself, it's to promote, you know, right. The Lord.
Right.
Well, yeah. Oh, yeah, I was just continuing to hit on this a lot, and I'm pretty sure that's what we're saying, but you're saying that the payment or whatnot is good job, well done. Thanks for, you know, the help, or not necessarily the help, but for the work you did.
Well, I'm saying that's a biblical notion. I mean, what we see Paul, when he talks about you're my joy and my crown and all of that kind of stuff, what he's saying is that on that day, I will look at my life's work and I will not be sorry about it. I will be glad about it, because you'll be standing, all these people who heard the gospel from me and who believed it will stand by me there, and my joy will be that I didn't go to them and teach them a bunch of truth. I made a bunch of error that led them away from the truth. I taught them what was true, and it had a beneficial impact in their life. And so that, yeah, I mean, you know, it's just a very natural and easy thing to understand.
So that's what you're thinking, the payment is?
Well, what I'm saying, yes, I think it is likely that that's what he means in this case. At least I'd like to propose it as a very serious alternative, because we know that that is something that Paul fought. I mean, his what he was looking forward to was the fact that he could say, you know, I was faithful in this, and that in and of itself was what he was looking for. Now for Paul, is it going to surprise me if in the kingdom of God he has a real important job there? No, that wouldn't surprise me at all. And would that be appropriate? Yeah, I think that would be appropriate, and it's fine with me. I mean, nobody's going to ask me anyway, but if they did, I'd say that's fine with me. I mean, I'm very grateful to Paul. I'm going to be one of the people standing there saying, Paul did a great job, because I didn't know him personally, but the book of Romans changed my life, and the book of Galatians changed my life. And I think they changed them in the right direction. So, I mean, that's a good thing. I think he would be right to feel a sense of satisfaction from that, even as he will also, as all of us as sinners will, look at things in his life and regret them. I mean, I wish that it hadn't been that way. But that's real different from seeing rewards as the carrot out there that I'm somehow pursuing that is motivating.
$1,000 and you want a condo on the beach.
Yeah. 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 It's not like that, I don't think. Okay, somebody else had their hand up. Yeah.
Take it you don't agree with that song where it proclaimed that the fellow that doesn't work hard just gets a rusty old halo, a skinny white cloud, and a robe so only it scratches.
I don't actually agree with that. That's good, though. I'd like to hear that song, but I think it's really important to understand that's not it. That when Peter says something to us like, fix your hope completely on the grace to be revealed to you at the revelation of Jesus Christ, he's saying, this is the culmination of your life. This is what you ought to be hoping for above all things. So it's not the sort of thing that's going to disappoint me when I get there because I didn't get a good enough job or something. I mean, that's not the picture. It's you know, there will be those who enter into this glory and those who do not. And that's the only really significant question is, were you a sheep or a goat? I mean, that's going to be the important question. I think that's from my perspective, that's just over and over again what the Bible says. Well, this might be a good time to stop. Thanks for coming.